I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences will name its Oscar nominees on January 24th. No, our own critics aren't involved in the nominating process, but that doesn't mean they don't have opinions on which film should receive accolades. Today, critics Steve Walker, Cynthia Haynes, and Bob Butler return to review the latest art, independent, foreign, and documentary films showing on area screens, including The Artist, Being Elmo, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, The Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, and others. We'll also hear some great indie film recommendations on video, just in case you'd rather cuddle up to the 42-inch widescreen. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. You may have heard that movie attendance is at the end of 2011 simply dropped off the table to some of the lowest numbers we've seen in years. Well, today's show is dedicated to reversing that trend, at least in the Kansas City area, as we review the latest art, independent, and foreign films now showing. We'll talk about The Artist, the French black-and-white silent film that has critics raving, Being Elmo, a documentary about the puppeteer who brings the Muppets Elmo to life, and Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, based on John le Carré's spy novel about a retired British agent who hunts down a mole in the agency. Our fearsome, ferocious critics are Cynthia Haynes, who taught film for 10 years at the University of Texas at El Paso. Cynthia, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Steve Walker is a contributing arts reporter at KCUR. Stephen, how are you?
I'm good, Steve. Thanks.
And Bob Butler, who programs film series for the Kansas City Public Library and blogs at butlercinemascene.com.
Happy New Year.
Good morning to you, too. Well, Cynthia, movie attendance is still down. What's up?
Well, the industry's in transition. They really don't quite understand how to handle the digital technology at this point. What with streaming, what with Netflix, it's a whole new ballgame. I think ticket prices are a factor. That's keeping people away. But I think the convenience of watching something at home, I think Melancholia opened the same time it was available on
It did.
Pay-per-view.
Pay-per-view. Right. Mm-hmm. So the theater owners are going, wait a minute, you know, where do we fit in all of this? And they've spent a fortune transitioning to digital technology to show films, you know, in a way you'll never be able to see them on a tablet or even your screen at home. So, you know, we don't know where it's going to end.
And with everything going digital, the projection, they're talking about smaller towns all across this country who have maybe one theater on the old Main Street. Those are going to be history. Absolutely. Because they can't afford to put in the equipment. It's astronomical.
It's $80,000 to $100,000 to go digital. And
for
screen.
One projector, yeah.
And that's – you try being a mom-and-pop operation with that sort of overhead.
And yet, I look in the paper and I see Chipwrecked, the third sequel to a movie we didn't need in the first place about the chipmunks, is making, what, $120 million? That's the mystery in this that I don't get.
I think it's taken the kids out of the house. That's a factor.
Okay. Well, maybe that's
What strikes me as interesting about this and it's scary in a way is that I always thought that the end of the year, end of the calendar year, you always saw some of the year's best films as the studios held back their best releases for play for the Oscars and the other awards programs. But yet, this is all occurring at the time, the end of the year, when attendance just absolutely plummeted.
Yeah,
you're right. You know, let me throw an aesthetic consideration into this. I love the convenience of video, of streaming, and all that stuff. But movies were meant to be a communal experience, mm-hmm. and I think we're in great danger of losing that. I mean, drama started as a religious festival in Greece, after all, and even so, the idea of gathering with people like-minded to experience something together—that's kind of a religious. You know, framework, actually. That's mm-hmm. what you do when you go to mass.
Mm-hmm. And we talked about how Melancholia, a movie like that, that brilliant opening 8-minute sequence, has to be seen on a big screen. Watching that on your phone. Speaking of phones, I went to see Mission Impossible at an AMC here in town. They give you two chances to put your phones away. three seats down, someone never got off their phone. And after 30 minutes of that blinding, that's another reason why I'm not going to movie theaters as often as I used to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so what are you saying, Bob? Well, what is the future here for the American movie theater?
I fear that movie going as a community event is starting to trickle away. I always compare it to going to church. I mean, you can get up on Sunday morning, pop a beer, and sit there in your underwear watching whatever the broadcast is from the Crystal Cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can actually shave, put on your coat and tie, and go to church. Now, which actually prepares you for the experience?
Mm-hmm.
Same way with going to the movies. The very fact that you hauled yourself out of the easy chair and drove to the theater, in a way, prepares you to appreciate what you're going to see.
Cynthia?
When I was teaching, made the comparison of looking at a work of art and a table, coffee table book versus seeing the actual painting on a wall. Same thing with some of these films. I mean, it's really difficult to watch them on a smartphone relative to seeing them on the big screen. But although the technology is such now, you can have a huge screen, a flat screen in your house.
Well, it just seems to me if people are going to the theaters now, they're getting into the habit of not going to the theaters. And that, again, sort of begins to snowball upon itself as we go forward, right?
No, that's right. I think people are just besieged with options from pay-per-view, Yahoo, YouTube, all of these things.
And we talked about Call to Duty on the other show, making billions of dollars relative to a movie these days. The younger members of the audience have these options of spending $50 and playing a game for 100 gazillion hours.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that factor, too. Bob, I do want to mention, I never forget going to see Young Frankenstein. I was the only person in the theater, and I sat there and I thought, this is one of Mel Brooks' most stupid movies. I saw it again with a friend in a packed theater. People were rolling in the aisles. I'm going, this is one of the funniest movies I've ever seen.
That's interesting.
Well, what is Hollywood? Is it Hollywood pressing the panic button right now?
They are.
What are they saying about this?
Well, if you read the trades,
It's
almost like somebody anticipating a stock market crash or something. They're flailing about. They really don't know what to do. The one audience they have been able to count on is young people who are dating, because young people who are dating want to get away from mom and dad. They want to get out of the house. So to that extent, you do have a loyal audience. Now, the problem is, what movies do you make for that particular audience?
The Saws, the Hostels, those kinds of
things. It's probably
not
something I want to see.
Mm-hmm. For that age group, there is cachet in being able to say, I saw the latest Saw sequel this weekend.
Well, but
that's a whole other
issue. if you see which films are making money, they really are the family films. I mean, The Muppets is even on the list of the 10 movies doing well. But the two key players in all of this that have thrown a wrench – or a spanner, as they say in Hugo, in the works, Netflix and Redbox. Mm-hmm. They are the game changers right now.
But even someone like Steven Spielberg, perhaps our most legendary American filmmaker, he's out with War Horse right now, which has gotten kind of mixed reviews, right?
Yeah.
No one's going nuts over the latest Spielberg film.
No.
But it's something you could take your kid to.
Sure. Yeah. And snore through it while your kid does the
Might
same.
Might enjoy it, yeah.
This is all kind of scary.
Well, I think that's why, again, we've talked about this on this show, that there is an audience out there who really is looking forward to seeing, for example, Iron Lady with Meryl Streep as Thatcher, which is opening next week, and Shame and A Dangerous Method and these really smart, intelligent films that our audience is, waits for and can't wait to go see, and thus the show.
And don't cost a lot of money to make, and subsequently don't have to make a lot of money at the box office.
I know I'm beating this into the ground here, but I took my family to see Mission Impossible over the holiday season. One film we could all go see together.
Mission Impossible.
We went to the theater on the plaza, and I was struck at how inexpensive the whole thing was. I think it was like $16 for the entire family for like a 4:30 showing. Which $4 a person didn't strike me as
now it was well,
that's a bargain.
It was more at IMAX, and it was initially released just in IMAX theaters for I think about a week. Made a ton of money, so it started the ball rolling, and now it's doing very well.
Well, speaking of awards season, which films from last year are sort of being viewed as having the best odds of being nominated for Best Picture honors from all the various awards programs? Where are we going here?
I think Hugo is going to switch, considering the people who are voting. It's an older audience. So it's an homage to early filmmaking. Same with the artist. I think we've got an older audience that's voting in the Academy, and I think those are the two films that are going to garner the most awards.
Hugo and the Artist.
Yes.
Bob Butler, what do you think?
I'm hanging in there for Tree of Life, if only because I think that there is an art wing of the Academy, and I think they're all going crazy over this one. It certainly has done well in some of the early critics voting. So, of course, critics, Oscar.
Yeah.
All right, never mind.
I would say The Descendants will be nominated for Best Picture. I did watch it again, by the way, to my fellow critics here, and liked it better the second time I watched it.
I like
it. Yeah. And The Help will be nominated.
Oh, definitely.
We didn't talk about it on the show because it was a huge Hollywood release that they weren't sure was going to do well. And it did extraordinarily well. It's not a great movie. Viola Davis is wonderful in it. But, you know, it'll be nominated for Best
Picture. But if I'm hearing Cynthia Haynes correctly, Steve Walker, she's sort of suggesting that Hugo might sort of be sweeping a bunch of categories here.
I don't know.
The technical categories?
Oh, probably.
Yeah,
editing, cinematography.
And you got to consider the source.
Scorsese. Yeah, they love Scorsese.
They love Scorsese.
Yeah, okay. Let's go to some films that are opening, I guess, today, right? Yeah.
Now, officially, The Artist opened at the Glenwood. Steve, I think last week, was it?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it opens today officially at the Tivoli. And
This is a French black and white silent film for people who love old movies, right?
Go figure. Why would anybody want to go see this movie?
Yeah, well, right.
I was so pleasantly surprised. I had heard all the hype about it, sat there thoroughly entertained, enthralled by this story. It follows a 1920s film star named George Valentine. How cute. Played by a wonderful French comedic actor, Jean Dujardin. And he falls in love with a starlet named, and this is another cute item here, Pepe Miller, and she's played by Bernice Bejeau. And his star fades while hers glows brightly, what with the advent of sound. So the whole time I'm thinking, Singing in the Rain, Singing in the Rain. It's a similar story, you could say. Now, we say it's a silent film. There are intertitles on cards, and there is a musical score, so it's not totally silent, but we will not be having any clips today as a result.
There are two scenes where there is sound used, and I don't want to even talk about them because
they're so
charming and perfect.
Yeah.
What I loved about this film is while it's looking at his career fading and hers rising with sound coming into play, there's some great metaphoric scenes. Like there's one of his big release right before all movies became talkies. He's mired in this quicksand within this dated, obsolete, silent film. And I thought, it's maybe obvious metaphor, but it certainly works. There's a scene of him walking up to the top of the studio. Well, he's going down and she's coming up and it's shot from really far back. There's a lot of little plays like that.
The way in which they play with the fact that there's no sound in the movie is quite wonderful. There's a scene early on, he's backstage standing behind the screen at the premiere of his new silent movie. The titles come up, the movie's over, and you can see him listening to hear the audience erupt in applause. We don't hear anything. It's dead silence, and you think the movie tanked. And then he grins and does a little dance, and you realize, oh, of course, we can't hear them. We can't hear anything. But he hears the audience.
There's really another lovely little scene where they first meet and they're warming up to each other. They don't become lovers necessarily, but they certainly become good friends. And it's five different takes of a movie
where she's an extra.
That's
a great segment, yeah.
And then she gets a little bit more screen time. And he warms up to her and she gets a little more. And the director, you know, we'll see the title say cut. And then we see the scene again. And we see how she's rising in visibility, and even as an extra in this film. It's really wonderfully done.
It was written and directed by Michael Hazanavicius. Is a French
Hazanavicius.
Okay, he is a French filmmaker who loved early movies, silent films, and wanted to pay homage to early Hollywood. And he did something very original, something very entertaining. He's paid homage to dozens of early films. I mean, I look forward to watching it again because there are elements of The Thin Man, Sunset Boulevard, and as I said, Singing in the Rain. John Goodman has a cute part in there is head of the studio. Mm-hmm. James Cromwell plays a chauffeur in the film. So you've got these great cameos, some really good actors, and Uggy, the adorable dog.
Oh, yeah,
and you guys are selling me on this thing pretty well.
Right.
And let me just say that Jean Dujardin, what an actor. Now, I saw him in – give me the director's name again.
Cazenovicius.
All right, whatever you say.
Thank you.
I saw him in that director's
–
that director made two spoofs of James Bond movies in France, which I thought were pretty lame, although I loved Dujardin in them because he really knew how to sell it. In this case, he's a bit of Errol Flynn. Well, not Errol Flynn. Who is the silent version? Douglas Fairbanks.
Douglas Fairbanks,
right. Yep.
With a bit of Charlie Chaplin.
And Gene Kelly.
And Gene Kelly, toward the end. So that is quite a heady brew.
Yeah, I'm just struck. How big of a gamble did these folks make in making a silent film, black and white film, in this day and age?
Well, you're asking how much did they want to gamble on making this, seeing that it makes money. I don't think Cazenovicius cared 2 cents about what money it would make. He's an artist, and he's made this film as an homage to silent film.
And it was his passion, and these other people believed in it, and it came about.
Harvey Weinstein with the Weinstein Company.
Weinstein obviously got behind it and has done great promoting. We went to a critic screening, and I have to mention that a younger critic made a comment like, what were those people smoking at the New York Film Critics Circle when they voted this best picture? Mm-hmm. I think a younger generation is not going to get it. I think film geeks like us will really love it. And I think there'll be a big difference in the kind of audience that sees this movie.
And so what's the age dividing line here, 35, 40?
I don't know. What do you all think?
I don't know. I mean, if you're a student of film, then
if you're a student of film, you'd love it.
I don't understand why these younger critics just dismissed it like they did. And I don't even know how it's doing in Kansas City.
I've been told that black and white hurts their eyes.
Okay.
Get out of here. That's three thumbs up for The Artist that opens up today at the Tivoli. It's already open at the Fine Arts out in at the Glenwood Theater, right?
Right.
Right.
Okay. How about a documentary about the puppeteer who brings the Muppets Elmo to life? The title of the film is Being Elmo, Bob Butler.
This is one sweet documentary. I got to admit, I really loved it. Now, it's directed by Constance Marks and Philip Shane, and its subject is a fellow named Kevin Clash, whom most of us don't know, but we certainly know Elmo of Tickle Me Elmo fame.
Yes.
Elmo looks a little bit like the Cookie Monster, Oscar the Grouch, only he's smaller and he's got red fur. And of all the Sesame Street Muppets, this is the one most beloved of kids.
Is that right?
Yeah. Now, this movie is actually three biographies in all. First, it's a biography of Kevin Clash, a kid who grew up, he's African-American, grew up in a borderline, neighborhood in Baltimore. As a young kid, he became fascinated with puppetry and started building his own, which for a kid living in a borderline neighborhood of Baltimore is probably an unsafe hobby.
Mm-hmm.
Before he was 18 years old, he was doing puppetry on Baltimore TV stations. He parlayed that into a gig with Jim Henson's Muppets.
Wow.
This is the story of his life. Now, it's also the story of Elmo, because Elmo was so unsuccessful a character that before Kevin took over, Elmo was going to be released. They were going to fire him. He was going to be banished. Kevin Clash decided that every character in the Muppet universe has to have one overriding personality, and Elmo's would be unqualified love. That's it. Elmo would represent love. There are scenes in this where he's visiting children in hospitals and things. Elmo's on his arm. He's talking. His mouth is moving. The kids don't see him. They talk to Elmo.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Wow. So anyway, he's the voice for Elmo,
He's the voice and the puppeteer. Now, on a third level, this is like almost a biography of the Jim Henson Associates, the rise of this industry based on whimsical puppet characters. So it works in three different levels. And if you're not, snuffling just a little bit in this, better go see a cardiologist.
I was going to say that, too.
Yeah. We have a clip here from this film, Being Elmo. It's about Kevin Clash's early experimentation with puppets.
I got this urge. I saw my dad's trench coat. Inside, there was this black fur. I thought, wow, that would make a great monkey. I just went off. I was entranced. I cut it up. And I made this puppet called Mondi. I put the puppet on my mom and dad's dresser. That's when I started getting really concerned about what he would do to me. So I hid. When I heard my name, I was like, oh no, here it comes. He said, what's his name? And I said, Mondi. The next thing he said was, next time, just ask.
Great stuff.
I was like,
yeah, yeah.
Want to let people know that tomorrow, Saturday, January 7th at 12:45 at the Tivoli, there will be live performance by local puppeteers who are from the Paul Messner Puppets. So that would be a great opportunity to take the kids and the rest of the family. I realized that watching the Muppet movie, and thanks to Jason Segel, my children grew up with Sesame Street,
sure,
and the Muppets.
Too.
There's a whole generation that doesn't really know about them. Thanks to Jason Segel, he's resurrected that. There's no Elmo in the Muppet movie. And I didn't realize that Disney bought the Muppets from the Jim Henson Estate in 2004. But the Sesame Street characters remain with the Children's Television Workshop. And there is a difference. There's an overlap. Hmm. Some of the Muppets wound up on Sesame Street or whatever. Tickle Me Elmo has turned out to be probably the most successful of the stuffed Muppets, and is still being sold as, you know, a very popular gift for kids. So there's some legal wrangling there, and I'd be curious. There's not much of a reference to it in the documentary, but how that affected.
Can I just add that there's a sequence of him visiting the set of Sesame Street when he was a high schooler, like on a field trip. And who shot all this old footage? It's never addressed.
Where'd they get it? Well, one thing I have learned over the years is that Jim Henson obsessively documented the rise of his corporation.
Really?
That's why there. If you get on, go to Amazon.com and check out DVDs about the Muppets, there are a half dozen or more documentaries about the Muppets made by the Muppet Company.
Because you start to think, have they been working on this film for 35 years? I didn't get that. And also, I just have to say, as sweet as it is for Elmo to visit the hospitals, I personally found it just a little off-putting and creepy.
Why?
To see this big, hulking man talking that little voice.
That's good, Steve.
That's very good.
Was it good? Thank you. It was weird.
Well, there's a disconnect. He's a big guy.
Yeah.
And
sweet guy.
And he's got, you know, he's living through this little red huggable creature. Yes.
Right. So you understand the nuances where it could get creepy.
You know what? I mentioned the three levels of this. There's a fourth, which is our ability to invest our emotions in inanimate objects when they are done right.
Mm-hmm.
Elmo's as real as any person you want to meet.
Well, you guys have sold me on this film, too, as you did the first film we talked about today, The Artist. Two films I was sort of wondering about, but both films sound pretty good. We'll have a complete list of all these films up on KCUR's website later on today. That's kcur.org. Let's move on to Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, based on the John Le Carré spy novel about a retired British agent who hunts down a mole in the agency, Bob Butler.
I like this movie. Now, I have to tell you, it stars Gary Oldman, who to me is one of the world's premier scenery gnawers. Gary
likes the camera.
I find Gary Oldman frequently provides a pothole in the road of a narrative, and I keep banging my wheel hubs in it. He overdoes it too often. In this case, he's perfect. He plays George.
Well, he's hardly there,
he's
Bob.
He's restrained. Yeah,
he plays
restrained.
George Smiley, the character that Alec Guinness played in the old PBS version of Tinker Tailor. And it's a wonderfully subtle, low-key performance. Now, a caution, go to this movie well-caffeinated, well-rested, and alert. Because this is not a movie that tells you what it's going to do and then tells you and then tells you what it did. You, like George Smiley, are on the trail of a mole within British intelligence. And it isn't like this movie stops and says, this is an important clue. No. Things happen. George Smiley absorbs them, and he expects you to absorb them too. And in your head, put together this mystery.
Yikes.
Who is the Russian mole?
How difficult a task is that?
I found a lot of people have complained that the movie is too complicated.
Yes, I'm reading that.
I didn't
Several
find
times.
That to be a problem. I mean, there were a couple of points where I was a little fuzzy, but overall, I thought it tracked pretty well. The trick, of course, is that they did it like it took 9 hours to do it back in the 70s when PBS did it. They're doing it in 2 hours and 20 minutes. I thought the director, Thomas Alfredson, a Swede who made the vampire movie Let the Right One In, does an amazing job of having it flow and yet be coherent, but maybe that's just me.
Well, let me just translate what Bob Butler just said. That means that I'll be going to theater with my wife leaning over halfway through saying, what's going on here?
You know, yes, you will. I think you will. But yeah. I stayed with it. I couldn't really tell what was going on. I was bored at times because Oldman's performance is all internal. He says about 10 words through the whole thing.
Wow.
But I stayed with it because I was somehow hooked. I don't know if that's the director or if it is, or John Le Carré's writing.
I didn't want to stay with it, but I did because I knew we were going to talk about it. I think part of the problem is in this day and age of Bourne Identity and Mission Impossible, we're watching a film about the Cold War set in, what, early 1970s,
probably, 73, yeah.
74, when the book came out. And it's just not as relevant anymore. Mm. It's just not exciting. It's sort of like, who cares that there's a mole in the British intelligence service that's, you know, going to spill secrets to the Soviets? That's another time. That's another place. And this movie is so cerebral that it lost me.
I'll tell you, it kicks alive when Tom Hardy comes on the screen. Tom Hardy is someone who by the end of next year everyone will know because he's playing the new villain in The Dark Knight, taking over where Ledger left off. He plays someone who's unlike everyone else in the movie, who are all buttoned up really in their suits and finery. And he comes in, this scruffy hippie, and you're just going, who the hell is he?
He's
and
a loose cannon field agent who kind of lives by his own standards.
That really worked for me.
Hardy did Warrior earlier this year. He was the gun expert in Inception.
Right.
He's a guy that's been in lots of movies. You're right. He's going to be monster before too long.
What's the clip we have here, Bob?
Good question.
Clip of them explaining what the title means, and they're using chess pieces with little heads of former agents
photos affixed
to them.
Photos of the agents,
right.
Yeah.
From Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy.
All I want from you is one code name. Alaline. Tinker. Aiden. Taylor. Bland. Soldier. Oh, we drop Sailor, it's too close to Taylor, and Rich Man doesn't seem to be applicable. Esther House. Poor man.
And the fifth?
Smiley.
Let's talk to a listener who has seen this movie and has an opinion about whether it's too complicated or not. Russ from Kansas City, Missouri, welcome.
Hello there.
Hi.
I found it easy enough to follow up, but I was actually paying attention. I just wanted to speak for the 3.5 viewers out there who are not between 12.5 and 13. Don't need neon flashing in their face continuously to keep their attention and appreciate a movie that appreciates their intelligence, or at least their ability to be adult. Yes, it's about a different time. It's called a period piece. I enjoyed it. I lived through those times. It was nice to see them through another lens. And quite frankly, it was nice to, as I told your call screener, it was nice not to be spoon-fed and then burped.
Very good. Very good comment.
Russ, thank you. So we have a thumbs up from Rapid Robert on this one. Not so much from Cynthia Haynes.
I'd say yes. No, it's in the middle, a bit more yes.
Okay. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about some of the latest art, independent, and foreign films now showing. We'll turn to The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and a whole bunch of other films as well. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our program yesterday about science fiction and the mayor of Wichita talking about the closing of the Boeing plant there, as well as our weekend to-do list, you can find it on our website, kcur.org. Monday on the program, we'll talk about manners, something our fearsome, ferocious film critics probably could use a little more of. They are Cynthia Haynes, Steve Walker, and Bob Butler, and thank you all for hanging around. How about another film that's now open, Cynthia Haynes? It's The Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. Tell us about it.
All right. I must admit I did not read the trilogy. I saw the Swedish version of the three books and liked that series tremendously. I thought the first one, the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, was the strongest of the three films. I was disappointed with this version. I much preferred the Swedish version of this story.
It's about what, Cynthia?
It's about a goth hacker and a journalist who are hired to investigate a murder. And it's the American remake of this extremely popular series of novels. This one was directed by David Fincher. We expect high quality from him as a filmmaker. He's notorious in a positive way for extraordinary introductory sequences to his movies and doesn't really fail with this one. Rooney Mara has replaced Noomi Rapace, the Swedish actress who played Lisbeth in the Swedish version, and Daniel Craig plays the male lead, who is the journalist, the disgraced journalist who's investigating this murder. I have to make the point that it's mind-boggling in this day and age that we would see such a horrific sexual assault in a mainstream movie. The thing that shocked me, not having read the book and seeing the first film, I was so taken aback by the extent of the violence in contrast to the character as she was developed up to this point that I was stunned when I saw the film. But to sit through it again in this American version, I did not consider it entertainment. It bothered me tremendously. And there are people, I'm sure, rolling over in their graves who established the production code that had a very strict list of rules and regulations about what you can see in a film. I'm not for censorship. I'm just expressing a personal
hard R.
Hard R.
You didn't bother you in the first one.
No, because it was so shocking and so unexpected.
It's a vital plot point, for
sure. It is.
I have to say that when we heard it was going to be remade, fans of the Swedish one put our, you know, our hackles up and said, oh, no, please, you're going to screw it up. Well, I have to tell you, David Fincher does not screw it up. I liked all the other three. I liked this movie a great deal.
I think this is on par with the Swedish version. I have no complaint, and I think Rooney Mara did a fantastic job of giving us Elizabeth that is not a carbon copy of the Swedish film, but develops aspects of this character that are different, and I found that very satisfying.
She's amazingly charismatic.
Even though she shaves her eyebrows and looks like a lump of wet
and
fur.
And she has all these piercings and dresses in a way that has been described as a way to say to the world, don't with me.
You know,
and I think she's so charismatic in this movie. And Daniel Craig is too. And I really liked watching their relationship.
Cynthia, the trilogy is called the Millennium Trilogy, but the author's original working title was Men Who Hate Women.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And I understand your point. It's a very hard scene to watch. She does get her revenge.
Oh, and that's almost as bad as watching the sexual scene.
It is.
It is very violent. But you and I love Drive, which was incredibly violent. It's just it didn't work for you.
Well,
it
I tell you,
no, it didn't.
And I want to say the early 90s, or when I think I've said this before, when I saw Jodie Foster in The Accused, who was very badly assaulted on top of a pinball machine in that film. That was a turning point for me. I really. A screen when I'm able to go watch and sort of get through anymore, because I have a really hard time with some of that stuff.
Good thing you're not a movie critic.
Well, that's that's right.
And I have to say, these opening credits of this film are, I don't know what's going on. It's like people made out of oil.
It looks like H.R. Geiger designed them, you know, the guy that designed the Alien.
It is amazing.
They're weird.
With Karen O of the Ya 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 singing Led Zeppelin's Immigrant Song over these bizarre black credits. It's just amazing.
What's the clip we have here, Cynthia?
They're meeting for the first time, Daniel Craig and Rooney Mara.
Yeah.
And he knows that she's already gotten into his email account.
And she's very reclusive. She's paranoid about anybody knowing anything about her. So when a man shows up at her doorstep, she's freaked.
Yeah.
This is from The Girl with a Dragon Tattoo.
Who is it?
It's Mikael Blomqvist.
Oh, Actually, I'm not really off yet.
May I come in, please? Hi. You and I need to talk. I've got us some breakfast. I'm sorry, I didn't realize you had some company.
Hey! Who do you think you are?
I'm the guy you know better than my closest friends do. Why don't you put some clothes on? Get rid of your girlfriend. We need to talk.
Okay. Have you seen it yet?
No.
No, okay.
I'm not sure I will, after, based on what you said.
Oh, I think it's it's really staying with me. I saw it just a couple weeks ago.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd see it again, and I don't say that about too many movies.
Okay, so two thumbs up from Steve and Bob, and not so much from Cynthia there for the girl with the dragon tattoo. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're visiting with our film critics about the latest art, independent, foreign, and documentary films now showing. How about a film here, Le Havre? An aging Frenchman and fellow villagers come to the aid of a young African refugee.
Le Havre is a port city in France, pretty seedy one, and it's about the shoeshine man who meets a family that's come over to France from Africa in a shipping container. The young son, who's about 10 or 11, gets away from the authorities. He meets the elderly shoeshine man again, who's got a void to fill. His wife's in the hospital with cancer, mm-hmm. and he's really lonely, and meets this boy and just kind of takes to him in a way, is like, this is wrong. I want to protect him. This kid doesn't deserve this. They're only wanting a better life, and you're getting the hint that this is a movie about the immigration scene on the French shores. And a lot of foreign films lately are dealing with how their countries are dealing with immigration. I think it's really interesting trend. And this is Finland's. The director is Aki Kaurismäki, who's from Finland. But the film is in France. It's Finland's Oscar entry for Best Foreign Film. And you've got all this global kind of cinema going on in this sweet little tale of a little boy and an elderly man as he's trying to find this kid's family.
You know what makes this film so special is its peculiar tone.
I was hoping someone could describe it. It's a fairy tale.
I describe it as a communist fairy tale. Now, it's a fairy tale. The old man's last name is Marx, and his dog is named Laika, which was the Russian dog sent into outer space on Sputnik.
I missed that.
And the entire community, this sort of wrong side of the tracks community living near the docks, all these people come together to raise money so this kid can have passage to London where his mother is. She's an illegal immigrant. Kid's an illegal immigrant. To do this, they bring out of retirement a guy named Bob, a rockabilly singer, and they raise money through a concert, which I have to admit is one of the most wonderful sequences I've seen in a while of what's his name? Lonesome Bob or something like
something like that, yeah.
He's a guy that performs in a red leather motorcycle jacket, and he's about 70 years old. It's kind of sublime.
Mm. But the tone you're talking about, this director just shoots. He's really okay with shooting a doorway with no one in it and just letting the camera sit there. And then the way he shoots people is so different. I don't even know how to describe it.
Well, he chooses faces that are eccentric in the extreme.
An old trick from Fellini,
of course. Noses and strange chins, and it's a real people-watching movie.
Wow. It's really a lovely movie.
It is, but I really did see it as a fairy tale. I thought it was very sweet. It's about optimism. It's about friendship.
Wow.
It's a great family movie. And the young kid, Blondin Miguel, plays the lead of the young African boy, and he deserves a lot of credit. There were a lot of weight was put on his shoulders making this film, and I thought he did a really good job.
Well, that sounds great. You're selling me on this.
Yeah, it's
too.
Really good.
Okay, that's Le Havre. And again,
I'm sorry. I wanted to mention it's virtually on every list of the best foreign films of the year, and I think the odds are pretty good it might get an Oscar or at least be nominated for an Oscar.
And it's playing at the Tivoli.
Yes.
Solely at the Tivoli. Okay.
All the films we're talking about today are on our website, kcur.org. How about some things going on here around the city in terms of movie-related kinds of events, Bob?
Well, I got a ton of them here. The library, the Kansas City Public Library, where I'm now employed, has a couple of things going on. In January, we have a film series called Robert Wise, Hollywood Journeyman. Robert Wise, of course, was the film editor of Citizen Kane, went on to direct movies. Everybody has seen two of his, West Side Story and The Sound of Music.
Wow.
We're avoiding those because everyone has seen them.
Right.
The things this guy has done. Here are some of the movies. We have I Want to Live, which won an Oscar
Susan Hayward. Movie.
Listen to it. Two science fiction, The Day the Earth Stood Still, come on, only one of the best ever, and The Andromeda Strain 20 years later. Wow. We have The Sand Pebbles, for which Steve McQueen received his only Oscar nomination. We have Somebody Up There Likes Me, which turned Paul Newman's sagging career around. And a film noir effort, Odds Against Tomorrow, about a heist. It stars Harry Belafonte and Robert Ryan, and it was shot on the streets of New York. And aside from the criminal aspect of it, it's about race. Now, these movies are being shown at 6:30 on Monday nights and 1:30 on Saturdays in the Film Vault of the Central Library. And if you go to kclibrary.org, you can get the full schedule. Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to mention that I spent a week with Robert Wise, along with a group of other professors of film at the invitation of the Directors Guild of America.
Wow.
He was one of the kindest, most generous, gentle men I've ever met. And to learn about all that he has done a film in just about every genre. And
exactly.
You don't realize that, but there so many of them are classics. And he is just a name. You hear Spielberg, you hear Scorsese, and you just don't realize what a contribution Robert Wise has made.
And the interesting thing about him is we use the title Hollywood Journeyman because unlike a Bergman or a Fellini, whose films you look at and you go, oh, well, that's a Bergman, that's a Fellini, he was a man that adapted to whatever was necessary to make this movie work.
Was this your idea to do this series?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Good idea.
That's what we
do. Real good idea.
Way to go.
And then, that isn't all. We have the psychoanalytic film series, which is being resumed. It's been going on for 6 years, and what happens is the Greater Kansas City and Topeka Psychoanalytic Center, its members look for films that they can show that describe the mental process, the emotional process, the psychoanalytic process. They show the film, and they have local therapists talk about it.
Yeah, they've been doing this for several years.
This happens at 1:30 in the afternoon on Sundays at the Plaza Branch. And the first one up is on the 15th. It's Vicky Cristina Barcelona, the Woody Allen movie. In fact, all the movies this year, Woody Allen movies. Gee, Woody Allen, therapy. Go figure. Anyway, the next one up is on January 29th, Crimes and Misdemeanors, and these will continue through February. So there's a lot of stuff going on. Again, KansasCityLibrary.org.
I watched Crimes and Misdemeanors again last week, actually, and just forgot how great a movie it is.
Unbelievably great movie, yeah.
Wow. I have a feeling they'll be showing We Need to Talk About Kevin some year.
You're probably right.
that'll be on their list.
Steve Walker, you had something to
Well, Jerry Harrington at the Tivoli is back to showing again a high-def production from the National Theatre of London. The one coming up on Sunday is The Collaborators. I don't know much about it. It's sort of like a dark satire about a playwright hired to write a play celebrating Stalin's 60th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting to me and what makes me want to go is that it's written by John Hodge, who wrote the screenplay of Trainspotting. So that's coming up and in a couple weeks, the Westport Center for the Arts they're bringing back mostly foreign film school returns on the 15th. Although I don't quite understand, the first movie they're showing is You Can Count on Me, which is not a foreign film.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's kind of interesting. WestportCenterForTheArts.org.
Cynthia?
The Englewood Theater has opened with The Sound of Music. Bob, you wrote a piece about this, right?
I did. It had been closed for 4 years. The Englewood is on Winter Road in Independence. It's sort of in the middle of a neighborhood. It's not in a big commercial district or anything, but it is a 500-seat, old-fashioned, single-screen movie theater. Wade Williams, a local film impresario, he reopened it, and they opened with The Sound of Music. This week, they have the Marilyn Monroe film, My Week with Marilyn. Now, he told me they are feeling their way here. They don't know whether they can go with revivals of classics, if they should do second runs of, you know, kind of art house fare. I wish them luck. It's a great theater. It's tough. As you well know, big theaters that can only offer one movie are at a distinct disadvantage in today's market.
Yeah.
Also at the Nelson Adkins on February the 2nd, we all had a chance, I think, saw the documentary Eames, the Architect and the Painter. It was at the Tivoli for a week or so. It'll be shown at the Nelson Adkins on February 2nd from 6 to 8:30, and the director, Jason Cohn, will be in attendance to talk about
that
the film.
That would definitely be worth going to
see
again.
And that is a good documentary. It really is.
Okay, again, we're talking about the latest in art, independent, foreign films now showing. Let's turn to some DVDs, Cynthia Haynes.
I came to the realization this past weekend when I stopped by a Barnes & Noble and was perusing the shelves of what was new on DVD and what was out in the Criterion Edition, that there are fewer and fewer retail stores where you can do that.
Mm-hmm. Where you can buy DVDs?
Look what's new. Look at what's classic.
Oh,
look
sure.
what's
oh,
available
yeah.
on DVD. And I've wound up watching movies I didn't really know existed, and when I found them on DVD, you read the box. I mean, sometimes the cover art is deceiving, but you know, you've
Where
got
Where do you go to get your DVDs, Cynthia?
I do try to shop at the local retail stores, mm-hmm. but I also rent them at Liberty Hall in Lawrence. Yeah. They have a fantastic collection
right.
of foreign art, independent, and documentary
yeah,
films.
Years.
So I get yeah. probably get most rent most of my movies there. Anyway, it's just not as satisfying as going to Amazon or Netflix and saying, if you like this, you'll like this. I'm
yeah.
missing the fact that borders closed in Lawrence.
Yeah, I understand. How about some other DVDs?
Well, I would recommend Jane Eyre. The three of us decided that we would just throw out three DVDs that you could rent immediately and would enjoy if you agreed with our reviews. And one of them for me is Jane Eyre, the Mia Wasikowska version. I think if it had been released later in the year that she would be considered possibly for Best Actress. Set design, costume. It's a beautiful version with Michael Fassbender. Hannah.
Judy Dench,
Jamie Bell. It's incredibly romantic. And on the DVD, you have the director's commentary and also a documentary about scoring the film. And a lot of students, I remember when they first started putting these director's commentaries back on, you know, the old laser discs, but now on the DVDs, it's like film school in a box. You learn so much about filmmaking by listening to these commentaries. Another one that I would recommend is Hannah.
We have a clip from Jane Eyre for you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Here?
Yeah, I think we do from last year, and that was last year, for a few months ago when I recommended it. And I think this is Jane exerting herself and addressing Mr. Rochester.
Let's find out.
I have lived a full life here. I have not been trampled on. I have not been petrified. I have not been excluded from every glimpse of what is bright. I have known you, Mr. Rochester, and it strikes me with anguish to be torn from you.
Then why must you leave?
Because of your wife.
I have no wife.
But you are to be married.
Jane, you must stay.
I become nothing to you. Am I a machine without feelings? Do you think that because I am poor, obscure, plain and little, that I am soulless and heartless? I have as much soul as you and full as much heart. And if God had blessed me with beauty and wealth, I could make it as hard for you to leave me as it is for I to leave you.
That's from Jane Eyre.
Oh, isn't that touching?
Yes, it is. How about Hannah?
Well, you know, I'm watching Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, and I'm flashing back on Hannah, and she's, you know, a gal who kicks butt. I mean, this is quite...
a 13-year-old killer.
Exactly. Quite the action flick. I think it's all done, so much of it tongue-in-cheek, that it's really kind of fun. Elizabeth Salander can't hold a candle to this gal, Hannah.
Go ahead.
No, that's all right. And then Win-Win.
I
really recommend this one. It's a terrific film, and Paul Giamatti is fantastic.
That's the wrestling movie, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Steve Walker.
Real quick, Bill Cunningham, New York. We've talked about it on the show a lot. It's about the fashion style photographer for the New York Times, who's in his 80s and still working. Crazy Stupid Love, I just recently saw. Hilarious teaming of Steve Carell and Ryan Gosling, who are hilarious together. I really liked that film. And I want to mention IFC Channel, the series Portlandia, which is Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein making – it's a satire about Portland, and it's season 2 starts tonight, but you can go to Netflix and stream the whole first series. It's hilarious. It's one of the funniest shows I've seen in a long, long time.
We're listening to a clip from
Portlandia. Oh, we are.
Yeah.
This is they're satiring that whole kind of Pacific Northwest mentality here. Fred and Carrie are playing a couple whose whole thing, their whole craft thing, is putting birds on things.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Bryce Shivers.
Hi, I'm Lisa Eversman.
And we put birds on things. Today we're going to go to a store on Mississippi Avenue. Nothing has birds on it. But you know what we're going to do? We're going to put birds on things.
Spruce it up. Make it pretty.
Thank you.
Put a bird on it.
Putting a bird on this teapot.
It's a bird.
I bet you it's flying all over the beach.
What a sad little tote bag. I know. I'll put a bird on it. Did you see this bag before? I didn't. Now there's a bird. It's flying. It's free.
I'm gonna put this bird right on this card.
It's so pretty.
You like that, ma'am?
Fantastic. Putting a bird on toast.
Put a bird on it! Look at this. I just sewed this bird right onto the pillow.
Oh, you missed this.
Ow! What are you doing? Watch your fingernails.
What about the bird?
Am I bleeding? Ma'am, am I bleeding?
No, you're fine. Stop looking at her. She's fine.
I know she's fine. I'm not.
Put a
bird
on
it.
Armisen and Brownstein play all kinds of different characters, from the feminist bookstore owners to, you know, vegan, dumpster diving vegans. It's hilarious.
Bob Butler, you had a couple of DVDs, too.
I do. Well, first is The Guard, the only movie that all three of us put on our end-of-year 10 best list.
Mm-hmm.
Brendan Gleeson rules. What can I tell you? 50-50, Joseph Gordon-Levitt is terrific as a 20-something who discovers he has cancer, and Seth Rogen plays Seth Rogen, but he's just right as his best friend. Something that only came out on DVD, I don't think it's played theatrically, it's a documentary called The People versus George Lucas. It's basically about the fanboys who went ballistic when George Lucas went back and redid the original Star Wars.
Yeah.
If I say to you, Han Solo didn't shoot first, do you know what I'm talking about? Well,
no.
If you do, this is your movie. What's wonderful about it is that in addition to being a celebration of geek culture, it asks the question, whose movie is it? The guy who made it or the people who fell in love with it? And who has the right to change it?
Cynthia, if you had to pick just three movies to see this weekend, you'd pick what?
The Artist, Le Havre, and Being Elmo.
Okay.
The Artist, Le Havre, and Young Adult.
Hey.
I'm going to go with Cynthia, The Artist, Le Havre, and Being Elmo.
Okay. That's our critics, Cynthia Haynes, Steve Walker, and Bob Butler. They join us every few weeks to review art, independent, and foreign films. You'll find a complete list of the films we talked about today on our website, kcur.org. Monday on the program, Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners. We had help this week from KCUR's Kim Noble, Danny Alexander, Tamika Weatherspoon, Brian Ellison, and Maria Carter. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. Our music today is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.